From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump announced his selections for three major posts in his administration today. He's offered the position of National Security Advisor to retired three-star General Michael Flynn, a dogged advocate and campaign advisor for Trump. Trump will also nominate Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo as director of the Central Intelligence Agency and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as attorney general. Those two will need Senate confirmation, but Michael Flynn will not. Joining us now with more is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi there, Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, remind us exactly what the position of National Security Advisor does, and given that, does the choice of Flynn come as a surprise?
Flynn is not as a surprise. He's been a Trump insider for a long time. He's been advising the campaign first informally as Trump began to reach out to people to ask for advice on national security and foreign policy, and then in a much more formal and structured way. And by the time of the Republican convention in Cleveland, Flynn was actually a speaker and went on to do campaign appearances with Trump or on behalf of Trump as his official stand-in or surrogate. He appeared on NPR. He appears on TV. And does the gamut on behalf of the president. So he's been on the inside for a long time. He's a former three-star Army general whose last job inside the government was to run the Defense Intelligence Agency. That's the intelligence service inside the Defense Department that focuses on military intelligence overseas. So what new widget are the Russians fielding, and how might the United States counter it or find out more information about it, that sort of thing. National Security Advisor is a very important and powerful job in the White House. Sometimes a lot of it depends on the individual president. If Trump has an administration in which he outsources a lot of authority and decision-making to his top leaders, Flynn could be one of the most important figures in the White House because he'll work directly for the president. He won't have been confirmed by the Senate and subject to that process, as you mentioned, and could have a lot of power inside the family, working with the Defense Department, the intelligence agencies, to work whatever goals they've decided they want to try to achieve and implement the visions and policies of the new president. The big question will be how much of what they campaigned on and talked about in a political context will they then try to put into place as policy, as the official conduct of the U.S. government once Trump is president.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because he did say some controversial things while the campaign was going on. I mean, remind us of some of his rhetoric.
That's right. So Flynn's comments on Twitter and in public about the potential threat from Muslims around the world and Muslim countries, Islamic countries in the Middle East, have struck a lot of people as at best insensitive. He has said there's every reason to believe, or words to this effect, that Muslim Americans might be a potential terrorist threat. And specifically, he's called on the governments of nations such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, and other putative allies of the United States in the Middle East to speak up more vocally about the threat posed by extremist groups like the Islamic State. He wants to hear them say in the open and public, in his words, how dangerous extremism is, and to disclaim it, and they haven't done so. So depending on how much he brings into government, it could be a very rough ride in terms of those relationships, or because you never know how people are going to govern until they're actually in the
right
job, he could try and moderate those comments and be a little bit more sedate, at least compared to a campaign context.
Now, Phil, you also mentioned that he had been director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. That was under President Obama because Flynn is a Democrat. But in 2014, he had to leave that job. What happened there?
That's right. And we should point out that Flynn is a Democrat technically, but he was a military officer at the time. So his party allegiance was less an issue given his role
right
inside the Army and the Defense Department. But that's correct. He threw a lot of sharp elbows inside the intelligence world. He was critical in a report that he did for a think tank about how the intelligence community basically wasn't pulling its weight in the war in Afghanistan. It wasn't telling commanders and the president what they needed to know about the larger context of the fight, and instead was focused on kind of very nose-to-the-grindstone day-to-day operations against extremist groups, which clearly the U.S. had to pursue, but in his view, it was losing the larger picture. As head of DIA, he tried to send people overseas and restructure the way the agency worked, but also clashed with senior staffers there and was seen to be questioning of and skeptical of the official policy that was coming down from the White House. Mm-hmm. So between that and getting cross-threaded with his bosses at the Pentagon, he was released in 2014, as you said.
Right. So Phil, just a couple seconds we have left here. I see that Flynn's also facing some criticism for business ties to Turkish or Russian governments. What do we know?
That's correct. And a lot of this comes from a report in Yahoo News yesterday by Michael Isikoff, the investigative correspondent, who says Flynn, as part of his campaign role, was getting intelligence briefings as part of the Trump transition, even as the firm he runs now as a civilian in private life had as one of its clients a Turkish businessman with ties, according to this report, to the leader of Turkey. Turkey has cracked down on internal dissidents there. But information security critics would argue that this opens him up to a lot of skepticism about where his ties are and what his conflicts might be as this transition goes on and he comes into the government officially.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing bringing us up to speed on what we know about Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we were in New York last weekend, it was impossible to walk around Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, where the Trump family lives and where his transition team is working. There were also protests at Trump International Hotel across the park and at another Trump Tower at the UN. So what is the view from New York? Well, here's Zoe Stark, who works at a law firm a block from Trump Tower.
I'm devastated by the results of the election, and I find it very disheartening and discomforting to come and leave work every day in what feels like a militarized zone.
Not everyone's unhappy. Reporter Stephen Nesson of WNYC is camped there at the Trump Tower. And what's it been like at that Fifth Avenue tower?
Sure. Well, just the surrounding streets are all blocked off to traffic flowing. These are one-way streets that feed into Fifth Avenue, and those are all blocked. There's several blocks of police barricades. That's in part because of all the protests that have been happening. Local workers in the area, I'm talking about construction workers, delivery guys, there's a lot of bike messengers in the city. They're having a really hard time navigating around Trump Tower. There's sort of a maze of barricades that they have to navigate through. One construction worker told me his work time is doubled because of this. Another guy who delivers fresh fish to high-end restaurants also said the time that it takes for him to do his job is doubled now, and that's real money that those guys are losing. It's definitely become a top selfie destination. It was already a popular destination, but now people are stopping by, and I spoke with some folks yesterday, and they're like, well, we got to come and get a selfie now because the president-elect is actually inside the building, which is hard for some people to even believe.
Well, and you're saying, too, though, it sounds like fans as well as protesters.
Certainly. Yesterday I was out there and there were no protesters, although there have certainly been protests nearly every day there at some point during the day. But certainly this is just a few blocks from Central Park, Rockefeller Center. This is a hopping area and a major tourist destination thoroughfare.
Yeah, and going to be even more so in the next few weeks during the holidays. What's the city doing? Because we know people have been complaining that they can't get to the stores nearby.
Sure. Well, traffic has certainly slowed down. You're not even allowed to pick up a taxi on Fifth Avenue in front of Trump Tower anymore. I ran into a woman yesterday who has leukemia, and she was walking very slowly with a walker and was told she still has to go around the block and around the corner to catch a taxi. The mayor is expected to address the issue later today. He's acknowledged that there is a real problem on Fifth Avenue now, especially with the transition going on. There's folks getting in and out of black cabs going into Trump Tower. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was there yesterday. So this is certainly a more congested area than it usually is.
The Trump Tower lobby, we understand, is a public space, though. Can people go in?
Absolutely. I ran into a British couple yesterday who just popped in for a muffin and coffee. They said it was very unusual coming out of the elevators because there is a scrum of media there who are just, you know, like C-SPAN is fixated on this elevator. They want to know who's coming in and out of Trump Tower, but it's true. It is open to the public. You can have lunch at Trump Tower if you desire. There's actually the Gucci flagship stores in Trump Tower. It's three stories. I was there yesterday, and it was totally dead.
Well, there's a related Trump story. Three residential buildings that are in the Trump empire, the people living in the buildings voted to remove the Trump name from the facades. What more are you hearing about that?
Well, let me just say it's three rental buildings. And while it's true Trump's name is on the facade, he has no ownership now of it. He did help develop those buildings with the help of a billionaire from Hong Kong in the 90s. And residents, I guess, were petitioning because they were appalled at his treatment of women, history of racism, they say, his attack on immigrants, mockery of the disabled, his tax avoidance. And as a result, they petitioned and it was removed this week. It was quite a spectacle with Cruz up in a cherry picker sort of taking off letter by letter. One worker sort of held up a T and waved it around and people were cheering. The Trump Organization sent out a statement that said, you know, this has been a long time agreement. If they want to remove it, they can remove it. He certainly has many other properties in the area that still bear his name.
Stephen Essen of WNYC in New York. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Social media is examining its role in the election. This week, Twitter suspended high-profile accounts associated with the alt-right movement. Facebook and Google have also announced plans to go after fake news sites. But what about nuanced reports? Social media may not be very good at that. At least one company is taking heat for appearing partisan, and Pepsi's taking a hit as well. Start with New Balance, the last major shoe manufacturer to make all or part of its shoes in American factories. Back in 2011, its CEO expressed concern about Vietnam being included in a potential free trade agreement. Then after the election, a Wall Street Journal reporter tweeted out that a spokesperson for New Balance said the Obama administration turned a deaf ear to us, and frankly, with President-elect Trump, we feel things are going to move in the right direction. Well, social media exploded, as did some sneakers. Kate Summers-Dawes is deputy managing editor at Mashable in San Francisco. Kate, we alluded to it, but New Balance was actually talking about something very specific.
Sure, that's right. New Balance was, and they clarified later that they were specifically talking about the TPP trade agreement, but users on social media were not happy to hear what they interpreted as support for President-elect Trump so soon after a divisive election day. They took this over under the hashtag boycott New Balance. They posted videos of their New Balance in flames. One user posted an image of a brand new pair of New Balance in a box with a lit match over it. And another wrote, quote, "I'd rather go barefoot."
Well, again, the reporter tweeted out, no, I had just asked them about the TPP trade bill. And they were saying, of course, that Trump was against the trade bill, which they are as well. And a spokesperson for New Balance wrote, as the only major company that still makes athletic shoes in the U.S., New Balance has a unique perspective on trade in that we want to make more shoes in the U.S. But as this went along, there were white supremacist groups tweeting out that they supported New Balance.
That's right. That forced New Balance to respond again, especially when a prominent neo-Nazi website posted that New Balance were, quote, the official shoes of white people. New Balance quickly responded via a spokesperson and said, quote, it does not tolerate bigotry or hate in any form.
Yeah. So tough times for New Balance there. Pepsi, kind of a polar opposite problem. Pepsi CEO Indra Nooyi told the New York Times that she congratulated Donald Trump on his win, said we have to move forward. But then she went on to make comments about her employees, especially those who aren't white, who are asking her, are we safe? And said she was in mourning after the election results. So she really had expressed an opinion about the election results. What happened there?
That's right. She also said that, quote, all her employees were crying. A Pepsi spokesman quickly responded, emailed a statement to the Chicago Tribune and said that the CEO, quote, misspoke. She was referring to a reaction of a group of employees she spoke to who were apprehensive about the outcome of the election. She never intended to imply that all employees feel the same way. But hashtag boycott Pepsi is now an active hashtag on Twitter as well. So President-elect Trump supporters were quick to react and respond to comments that they interpreted to be disparaging to them and the candidate they preferred.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with those products, both sneakers and, you know, a soft drink. But meanwhile, there's at least one person trying to get away from politics. The pilot on the United flight from San Francisco, when, according to some onboard descriptions, there was a fight that started between two passengers?
Yes, that's right. This was a video posted on YouTube on November 11th, so very quickly after the election took place. It now has about 500,000 views. And according to the video description, one passenger said, quote, something racist about being glad to have kept his guns to an African-American woman. They apparently had to be separated, which caused the captain to come on the intercom with a stern message for passengers.
Let's listen.
And what I do ask is that as people, we have the common decency to respect each other's decisions and to get along on this 3-hour and 13-minute flight.
He goes on to say, no politics on my plane. And apparently everybody began clapping.
That's right. He also says that if anybody needs to vent or rant or rave, there's another flight tomorrow. They're not going to be on this one. And everybody began to applaud. And according to the video description, the man went to the back of the plane and apologized to the woman after apparently they were separated. And one of the comments, I think, summed it up by saying, quote, it's pretty sad when you have to lecture full-grown adults the same way you lecture a child.
That's Kate Summers-Dawes, Deputy Managing Editor at Mashable, with a look at how some of the election news filtered through social media. Kate, thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to be here.
Well, turning to broadcast media, the NFL is the most watched sports league in America, but it's not invincible. Ratings are way down this year. Week 7, for example, saw viewership drop compared to last year in every single time slot, culminating in one of the worst primetime football games in recent memory. The Seahawks and Cardinals played to a Sunday night 6-6 tie, featuring two missed field goals in overtime.
I guess if a game deserves to wind up in a tie, this is the one. Ryan pushed it down. Hauschka just pulls it.
I'm just telling you.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Eric, what is going on in the NFL?
Are you ready for some football? I guess some people are not. But no, actually, we should point out that this past Sunday was a rebound for ratings. And some people say, not coincidentally, it was the first Sunday after the election was decided. And we saw a matchup between the Dallas Cowboys and the Pittsburgh Steelers that did very well. And we also saw a matchup between Seattle and New England that did well. But factoring out those two games, we have seen some really serious drops in viewership for football games. For example, CBS and the NFL Network air Thursday night football games. Their ratings have gone down 16% this year versus the year before. We've seen some similar drops on Monday night football on ESPN and some of the Sunday games. And it's starting to worry the NFL and worry sports fans.
Yeah, in an internal memo sent last month, league executives said they remain confident in the NFL, unconcerned about
nothing to see here.
Yes, but you know, talk about how this might impact, like, advertisers. They like live TV because you have to watch their ads.
Well, you know, the sports, and especially football, has always been considered sort of bulletproof programming. While the broadcast networks saw declines in viewership, the NFL saw a rise in viewership. But now that we're seeing some softness in these ratings, we're seeing a sense that maybe people are getting to the point where they're showing up for the games, but they're really showing up for games where the matchups are really competitive, where there are some stars that are going to perform that they want to see. And that the average football games may start to decline in viewership, indicating that sports programming and live football games especially is now starting to reflect the same kind of viewership trends we see in regular scripted programs.
We should say we've talked about this before from a sports point of view, and there's also the fact that the games haven't just been as great. You know, they're not as compelling as witness the two missed field goals. So that's a factor as well. But talk about ESPN. The cable network giant lost a record number of subscribers last month, according to Nielsen. Why?
Well, there's always been this concern that as cable bills rise, people start to cut the cord more. And ESPN has always borne a lot of the blame for that because they charge so much to cable systems to carry the channel. I would point out that with these games, there's been a lot of theories. One of them is that the election has sucked up the energy of the viewers. But the thing that scares me is this idea that the election sapped viewership indicates maybe that we're watching the election the same way we're watching a football game, which is maybe a little disconcerting.
All right. Speaking of failing sports shows, HBO announced earlier this month it's canceling Any Given Wednesday. That was the weekly sports show hosted by Bill Simmons. We knew him back when he was the Boston sports guy.
Right.
He got huge with his Twitter feed and his kind of a
podcast. Yeah. And he, of course, founded Grantland, the amazing website that ESPN had for a long time that mixed sports and pop culture.
Well, here's a clip of Any Given Wednesday, which started just about 5 months ago. Here, Simmons is interviewing NBA superstar Kevin Durant, and he asks him about a trade that happened 4 years ago.
Did you stop liking me because I kept bringing up the Harden trade too much? I felt like you were mad at me for like 2 years.
No, I wasn't mad at you.
Okay. You weren't?
Nah. I thought you should have got over it quicker than what you did. But I wasn't upset. I was kind of puzzled.
Eric Deggans, what was wrong? What was wrong with this show getting canceled now?
I think maybe you heard it in that clip. It's like, I'm not sure people are tuning in to see Bill work out his, whatever personal grudges he has with sports stars. You know, well, the show got a lot of criticism when it debuted. Some of it I felt was kind of unfair. I mean, Bill has had a lot of success on a lot of different media platforms, and I think maybe some people were waiting and maybe even hoping to see him fall on his face a bit. I also wonder if HBO's audience really wants to talk about sports or see sports talked about in that way. I've always felt that HBO's audience wanted sports programming that was a little different, and this felt a little too much like an ESPN chat show. So I think that might have been their biggest problem, to be honest.
Well, Eric, we want to let you go, but I'm going to switch gears for a second because I know you want to express a thought on Gwen Ifill, who also got her start here in Boston at the old Boston Herald American newspaper. She was a real journalist and died way too young, 61. Right. Funeral services for her today and tomorrow in Washington, D.C. Just your thoughts.
Yeah, well, you know, I like a lot of folks in journalism, especially a lot of people of color, I cross paths with Gwen a lot. And I think we're going to miss this idea. She was always about trying to illuminate a situation but not build up controversy, or there was no sensationalism. And we certainly need a cool, steady, experienced voice like that helping report on politics in this moment. Mm-hmm. And so to lose somebody with her ability to cut through the issues but also be very personable and compelling, that's a huge loss for the journalism industry too.
Yeah. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
In Minnesota today, Officer Geronimo Yunez is making his first court appearance after being charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of Philando Castile. Castile is the 32-year-old black man who was killed during a traffic stop in a suburb of St. Paul in July. Prosecutors say Castile told Yunez that he was licensed to carry a gun and that he had one with him. Castile went to reach for his ID, and that's when he was shot by Officer Yunez. You may recall Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, broadcast much of this over Facebook Live while it was happening. Tim Nelson is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. And Tim, what's the reaction been in the community that charges were actually filed in this case?
I think it varies. You know, a lot of people have been very upset recently. We've had a number of these cases, particularly another young man in Minneapolis, Jamar Clark, who was shot and killed by Minneapolis police during a confrontation there back in November, led to a lot of protests that closed the freeway. And a lot of people expected that this was kind of go that same way, that there wouldn't be any criminal charges. No one ever remembers, at least in recent history, there being criminal charges against a Minnesota police officer who uses deadly force against a member of the public, particularly an unarmed member of the public. And so they kind of expected this to go the same way. And there was, frankly, quite a bit of relief among some people that this was different this time. That said, you know, police are obviously disappointed that one of their own have been charged in this case. And the trade organization and union for police in Minnesota says that they fully expect this officer to defend himself in court in the weeks to come.
So Officer Yunez is appearing for his arraignment today. Is that right, Tim?
That's correct. He's making a first appearance. It's just sort of a brief appearance. He's not going to make a plea here. That comes later. There may be some discussion of bail, and we expect that there will be some effort to raise that bail for him and get him out of the Ramsey County Jail today.
What more do we know about him?
Not very much. He's only been on the force for 4 or 5 years. We've seen his training and education records. He was, you know, educated and trained here in Minnesota, but it's really a very routine career for an officer in a small suburb of the Twin Cities. So unremarkable in any way that we found so far.
Is that fact in and of itself one of the reasons why, I mean, you were talking about this case is unprecedented in Minnesota. Are people now asking questions about training, about recruitment amongst law enforcement, that kind of thing?
There are a lot of questions being raised, particularly about the nature of sort of routine policing. It came to light after Philando was killed that he had been stopped by police 52 times in a little more than a decade before this last incident. And there's a lot of question about the routine interaction of police, whether it's traffic stops or stops on the street, and interactions that police have, particularly with the African-American community, and how that should be approached. You know, at what point do they need to escalate, and at what point, you know, do they need to be examined for whether or not they're being conducted fairly? And I think we've kind of reached that point. We're looking very hard, not just at these cases, these use of deadly force cases, but kind of the routine interactions that finally lead up to them, wondering if there's any clue or indication of what brings these on in the routine interactions.
Well, Tim Nelson is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Tim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Modern-day Sherlock Holmes are all the rage. Public television viewers are awaiting the return of Sherlock in January. It's set in present-day London. Holmes' sidekick Watson keeps their chronicles on a blog. CBS's Elementary is set in New York. Watson is a woman. Sherlock Holmes is in recovery for his addiction issues. But now a new novel makes Sherlock a young black man in a troubled neighborhood outside Los Angeles. Or, as author Joe Ide says, Sherlock in the hood. Although Joe himself grew up in South Central L.A. and wants people to know black neighborhoods are much more than a hood. The book is IQ. It's the first novel from former screenwriter Joe Ide. In her sparkling review, the New York Times' Janet Maslin says it kicks off what is apt to be a madly lovable new detective series. And Joe Ide joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and congratulations, because am I correct in thinking this? Maybe you tell me if I'm not. Maybe I'm not. That you went out on a little bit of a limb here. You are Asian American, and
yes,
you are writing about African Americans.
I am.
Did you ever think, can't go there?
No. Never crossed my mind.
Well, and Janet Maslin also says, and I would second, you've got a great ear. Was this from growing up in South Central that you felt that this was a story you could tell?
Oh, yes. All my friends were black. And so I co-opted their speech and their style and their attitudes and pretty much all of it. And so, in effect, the vernacular was my first language. And I practiced it every day. I mean, it was really part of me. Mm. And so that was really one of the easier parts to do.
Yeah. Well, and also you combine that knowledge of what you're writing about with this childhood love of Sherlock Holmes?
Yes. He absolutely fascinated me. Here's this guy who can control his world with just his brains. And being a small kid, you know, in a neighborhood where walking home from school could be life-threatening, you know, I thought that would come in handy. And so I really obsessed over those books. I read them, all the stories and all the novels, multiple times.
That's such a wonderful image of a little Asian kid in largely black South Central reading Sherlock Holmes.
You know, I've never thought of it that way.
You haven't?
No. No.
Well, here you are, and the result is the book IQ. IQ is Isaiah Quintabe.
Yes.
A young African-American with Holmesian powers of observation. He's kind of the go-to guy for neighbors who have a problem and they can't go to the police. He has this ability to sort of see things and deduce things. And maybe he gets paid for the problem he solves with a sweet potato pie or a new radial tire. Is he a stand-in for you? Is he maybe the young African-American you wanted to be?
Yes. He is.
Joe, I could just ask you to lie down on a couch and we could do that. You could then pay me $150 at the end of the session.
There was a little too much emotion in that response. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he is who I wanted to be and wouldn't mind being now.
Yeah.
He's so smart and he's so quick on his feet and he has all these real world skills. None of those things really apply to me. And so, yeah, he was my alter ego, is my alter ego.
Well, but he's also a kid in a very troubled neighborhood who is a pretty straight arrow most of the time. You know, we don't want to give a lot of the plot away, but book smart in an area where that, you know, he's sometimes mocked for it.
Yeah, he is an oddball in his environment. You know, he wears no bling. There's no studs in his ears, no rims on his car. He doesn't listen to hip-hop. He's quiet and he's watchful, and he has this kind of behind-the-eyes cool. You know, he sort of reminds me of Sidney Poitier in the Heat of the Night. You know the man is there. He's soft-spoken, but if you slap him, he'll slap you back.
Yes. Well, and it's funny you mentioned, you know, thinking of Sidney Poitier and Heat of the Night, because we mentioned you are a former screenwriter, and it's very cinematic. I mean, right in the opening scene, there's a car chase. Are you still thinking like a screenwriter when you write for a novel?
Yes. I can't write it if I don't see it. I have to have the scene in my head. I have to have the people talking in my head, or I can't get it down on paper.
Yeah. So take us through some of the plot. There's a hip-hop artist who's sort of trapped in his house by his own demons and by a sniper who is out to get him. And one of the scariest attack modes I think I've read in a long time, he sends a pit bull in.
His stage name is Black the Knife.
The hip-hop artist, yeah.
He's depressed. You know, he's one of those people who's invested the meaning of their life in the things he can accumulate. And he's accumulated everything. You know, he's got an overcoat made from 6 cheetah hides and 600 pairs of shoes. And since he has all this stuff, he no longer has a reason to go forward. And so he's absolutely inert. And it's in this, he's in this state when he discovers someone wants to kill him. And because he's locked up in his house, there's no way to shoot him. And so this hitman, this very strange young man named Skip, sends in his pit bull, who he's bred to be huge. This pit bull, most of them are about 60, 70 pounds, good-sized male. And this dog weighs 130 pounds.
Look, Cal, the hip-hop artist, and his ex-wife have phenomenal battles. He has her shoe collection frozen in concrete. They compare each other's body parts to things that aren't very attractive. epic fights. Again, do you ever worry about, there's a lot of reality in your fiction. If you read the tabloids, do you ever worry about, you're mocking part of the African-American culture, which is this huge lifestyle of the hip-hop artists?
It's more that I'm making fun of wretched excess than I am any particular culture. Rap is extremely excessive in many ways. And so I have no beef with the rap world. What I have a beef with is wretched excess.
Mm. Well, another character, is it Juan L. Dodson?
Yes, Juan L.
He becomes, is it fair to say, the Watson of the story? He's IQ's sidekick. He's got every scheme going in the world. At one point, he wants to sell to high school students. He comes back for one of those career days to his high school, and he starts selling the kids this bling, these heavy chains that he makes. And it's, what, rent a bling? You can rent?
Yes, you can.
Rent your own chain, big enough to put a crick in Kanye's neck. But that's more about wretchedness, you know, trying to make it. Are these people you knew?
Oh, I knew many people on the hustle. There were so few opportunities in my neighborhood that many, many people were on the hustle. And that was, you know, that was not a character thing. That was necessity. And Dodson embodies every hustler I ever knew. Mm. He's also, for me, I was obsessed with stand-up comics when I was a kid. Mm. And I had this big stack of LPs of Red Fox and Moms Mabley and Richard Pryor and a whole bunch of people. I'd listen to them over and over and over again, and that worked its way into Dodson, too.
Oh. There's a lot of love around all of these characters, even the most outrageous rapper. It sounds like it's a little bit of your love letter to your neighborhood.
It is. That sort of facade of being a kid from the hood really served me well. I mean, you know, I came from a family that was Japanese-American in a black neighborhood, and I really had no way to be in the world. And assuming that identity made me feel at least that I belong somewhere, that, you know, I fit in. And it was only a facade, but it really, in many ways, helped me survive when I was a kid. And so I have a real... I have a real affection for the neighborhood. And, you know, my neighbors were just so cool. And I felt myself to be so uncool. You know, they could wear, you know, the same hand-me-downs as me. And somehow they would look cool, and I would look like I just jumped off a freighter from North Korea. Well, and so I was just so envious. And so, yeah, I look back with deep affection.
Yeah, that's Joe Ide. IQ is the name of the novel. Joe, thanks so much, and thanks for talking to us about it. Best of luck.
Thank you very much, Robin.
The UN Climate Change Conference in Morocco wrapped up with this appeal from the attendees. Our climate is warming at an alarming rate, an unprecedented rate, and we have an urgent duty to respond. Scientists say 2015 was the world's hottest year since measurements began, and 2016 promises to break records again as carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continue to warm the planet. So how warm could it get, and how fast? Well, a research team has begun an unusual experiment in a Puerto Rican rainforest to try to find out. Daniel Grossman reports.
So, vertical alignment of all six posts, looking for rust and anything that's not looking safe.
Scientist Tana Wood is checking wiring on a powerful electric heater. The device hangs from scaffolding in a mountainous patch of jungle at the Luquillo Experimental Forest in western Puerto Rico. Altogether, the test area is about the size of a suburban lawn. Wood is here to study how this forest will respond to climate change. Specifically, how much carbon dioxide, if any, tropical forests will absorb or conversely release in the future.
What we're doing here is really trying to understand how temperature affects tropical forest functioning. So what does increased temperature do to processes like photosynthesis, and how are the microbes responding?
Trees absorb carbon dioxide by adding vegetation. Microbes release CO2, along with methane, by breaking down vegetation. And in a warming world, we need to study the effects of these processes in tropical jungles, says ecologist Jerry Melillo.
It's something that I've been calling for a couple of decades.
Melillo is a researcher at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. He's been using buried cables to heat a forest near Boston for 25 years. He says the equatorial band of jungle that includes the Amazon and the Congo contains a huge inventory of carbon. Even a little warming might stimulate microbes there to begin liberating CO2 and methane in a vicious cycle.
A self-reinforcing feedback so that warming will beget more warming.
Constant rain and humidity, stressful for electronic instruments, and isolation make tropical rainforests challenging for research. The Luquillo Forest here in Puerto Rico is no exception. Tana Wood has wired up six identical plots, three heated and three unheated controls, with scores of sensors connected up like a hospital patient by skeins of cables and tubing. She suffered one setback after another. Last summer,
we got ants that got into our lines.
The tiny insects exhaled CO2 into sensitive measuring gear, messing up results.
And then we had a power surge,
burning out a custom-made controller for her 18 high-powered heaters.
And then that blew out the fuses in all three of our control panels.
After repeated visits by electricians, Wood got the operation back on its feet. But now, just as she's about to flip on the heaters for the first time, a new problem has come up.
We just got all of the equipment back on Wednesday, installed it, then realized that we were still having some values that didn't really make sense.
Wood walked to her field office and calls her equipment customer support line in Las Vegas.
Hi, yes. I had called earlier and was talking with James for technical support.
One moment, please.
James, the technician, says a very special light bulb deep inside the device may be defective. But he says try removing the bulb and tap it gently. The project manager, Aura Alonso Rodriguez, gets to work removing screws and disconnecting wires. To their delight, the fix worked.
The flux is back to normal again.
Great, that's great news.
I'm coming down. I think we're ready.
It's time to turn everything on.
It's been 7 years since we first decided that we were going to warm a tropical forest. And, you know, today is the realization of that dream. It's just really incredibly exciting.
Not long after, the two researchers huddle over a laptop computer in a small air-conditioned closet. With the click of a mouse, they start up the experiment. The heaters raise temperatures by about 4 degrees Fahrenheit in less than an hour. Over the following days, they warm the plots another 4 degrees. Wood will be measuring the carbon output of the plants and soil microbes to see how much CO2 they're giving off or absorbing. She says it will take time to draw any conclusions from this research. She hopes to keep her project going for at least 2 years. For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman, reporting from the Luquillo Experimental Forest in Puerto Rico.
And Dan's story was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Christ. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.